Being outside of Palestine, even within a short period, you realize how much we are denied the right to reflect and capacity to reflect, and how important that is for understanding the overarching reality. But we're too busy trying to breathe and surviving. So being outside is, it really has me questioning not what I am witnessing. I understand what I am witnessing. I understand it as colonialism. I understand it as violence. But what do we do with that? Do we, again, do we just document an archive? Is that my job? To just write obituaries? But it's not. So I'm trying to really try to remember, what are the things that are also missing? You know, not better, just missing, just adding to the gaps. And it's the daily. Colonialism is intimate. And of course, it's hard to even say the word colonialism because it is so denied in journalistic practice. It's reduced to activist talk to try and deny the right for people to see it as a real and accurate term. It's just, oh, activists. It's used often in a derogatory way. But it is colonialism. And colonialism is intimate. It gets into the intimate spaces. It impacts a family sitting in a living room and they're too scared to speak politics. So you just notice a small talk and trying to not. It's, you know, with me, even as a journalist, when my mom calls me and she's like, and I'm saying my own, you know, it's the only space I feel like I can share my actual opinions. She's like, no, mom, we don't talk about things like this on the phone. You know, and I realize it's that engineering of fear also because of surveillance. It's not invalid. It's very valid paranoia because we're heavily surveilled. So it's these stories, the details, I think, that require long form reporting, where just the banal elements, a story about the cemeteries and how Palestinians aren't able to even just bury someone, and that practice of burial and grievance and funeral and how important that is. But what it does to a society when it's denied, you know? And yeah, it's for me, it's the stories of the details. It's the story of, I remember this image in my head in maybe 10 years ago in Nabi Saleh, a village in the West Bank near Ramallah, where weekly protests were happening. And there was a soldier grabbing an older man into, an Israeli soldier grabbing an older man into the military jeep, trying to detain him with all their guns. And this man that just has his clothes on, and his son, who must have been 4 years old, 3 years old, just tugging on his father, no, no, don't take my dad. And then, you know, fast forward 15 years later, and I'm interviewing these fighters in the camp. And they would tell me stories, you know, they were arrested when they were 14 years old and they've experienced and seen violence and couldn't protect the people, their mothers and fathers, the people that are supposed to protect them, were being violently attacked. And as a child, you can't protect that. That does things to you. So when I saw the fighters, I really kept going back to these images that if we really understood that moment of 10 years ago, if I understood just and covered perhaps that moment, maybe it would have been clearer for the world. Even 15 years later, if nothing changed, just clearer to understand how that happened. How do you go from here to becoming a fighter? And that helps explain the story. And that's long form. That is sitting and that's storytelling as well. And I think that's something that's missing in the reporting on Palestine, because Israel would rather the world think Palestinians don't exist, so we're not worthy of long form, or were just dead or about to be. And that, yeah, denies that capacity to say our stories. And then the most important thing about, as a Palestinian, and I keep this, I'm very focused on the stories from Palestine because that is the area I know well, but I in no way, in shape or form, think it is an exceptional case. I think we see parallels and patterns around the world of similar dynamics. One really significant thing that I think is missing from the storytelling, the reporting, the archiving and the documentation on Palestinians is we're more than the occupation. We're more than what the violence is. And we even forget that about ourselves sometimes. And that's something we reflect on when we're outside of there. But we're more than that. And I think the stories of, yeah, why did Palestinians in Gaza survive? I think it's nothing short of a miracle with the amount of bombs dropped on such a small place. Why are Palestinians in the West Bank still there? When I think if anyone faced just a fraction of the situation there, it would be uproar, at least I think in the global north. So why? And it's those stories of community. And perhaps when we speak about the daily resistance in Palestine, our minds might go to the good things, you know, community sticking together, checking it up on one another, just how, you know, we're built as a society, the family, the neighbor. And these things are what helped us survive. But also sometimes it's just something really silly, like we're stubborn or we're being arrogant, you know, and we're just, it's not always something so grand and magnificent. Sometimes people tell me, how do you do it on the field? Like, how do you overcome fear and things like that? And sometimes the real answer is, oh, I didn't even see the soldiers. I actually just missed them, you know, and I didn't get scared because I just didn't see them. But it's because they were two blocks down. So it's things like that that help survival. Sometimes just not being aware.
Mariam Barghouti is a Palestinian-American writer, journalist, and researcher based in Ramallah. Her trajectory moves from student activism at Birzeit University to graduate studies in sociology and global change at the University of Edinburgh, where she specialized in the discourses and mechanisms that legitimize state violence. From there, she went on to spend more than a decade reporting from the front lines of Palestinian life. Barghouti writes from the inside out, not as an outside observer parachuted into crisis, but as someone for whom the political is inseparable from the personal and the everyday. As a founding editor of Communicating Palestine, a platform dedicated to building ethical narratives about Palestinian life under occupation, she has documented Israeli military operations, settler violence, the targeting of journalists, and the slow violence of occupation that rarely makes headlines. Her writing refuses the false neutrality often demanded of Palestinian voices, and insists on naming colonialism for what it is. At the same time, it challenges a world that permits Palestinians to speak only as witnesses to suffering, not as experts on their own reality. In this podcast, Mariam Baghouti talks about the double labor of journalism when you are both its practitioner and its subject. The negotiations with editors, the hierarchy of credibility in international newsrooms, and what gets lost when the only legible Palestinian is the suffering one. As she argues, before the bombs are dropped, people are killed with language. So we spend time dissecting seven systemic levers of narrative that sustain the manufacturing of consent and danger, that make Palestinian life either hyper-visible as tragedy or invisible as politics. And we return again and again to a conviction that runs through all her work. Palestinians are not victims waiting to be documented. Palestinians are people in struggle, determined to remain.
I do also have a background in research. So I used to develop methodologies for different research on, sociological questions happening in the Levant, not just in occupied Palestine, and to evaluate humanitarian aid missions in the area. So methodology is something that's really specific that helped me recognize that really it's not just about what you do, it's how you do it. And it helped me recategorize not just kind of how I archive my notes, but recategorize the knowledge that I gain. So I do have a different filing system for the different stories. But in terms of note-taking, I keep it very basic. And I learned this from a Palestinian journalist. Her name is Nidal. In fact, she works a lot with the Reuters and many areas in Palestine. And I remember she took me when I was like maybe 19 at the time, in my teens. And she looks at me with my messy notes. She's like, Mariam, what is this? We need to be organized. We need to be organized. Isn't there a story to tell? And she grabbed my notebook and she just taught me something very basic. So I just number my notebooks and I have an index in front of every notebook and a sticker on them of the year and the main interviews in it. So it's good because now when I'm asked to verify something, you know, my cabinet of file field notebooks, it's very easy for me to access it. So that's my system. It's basic, but it does wonders, you know? So my bachelor's degree is in literature. My graduate studies I did in sociology and global change. A lot of my focus was on Israeli studies. So I kind of studied the development of Israel through what was Jewish identity in the U.S. And that I finished that in 2019. And it really helped me just become so aware of the importance of good journalism because of narrative building and what it can do in the long run. So it was looking at, you know, the reports in the U.S. On race and on different groups of people there and what that meant 70 years later for a colonial state. So I was able to see that comparison. And that helped push me return kind of into more methodological research and then towards journalism. But I returned to full-on reporting in 2022. When Shirin Abu Akleh, a Palestinian journalist, was killed in Jenin. And that was just the striking need for me that we need more journalists on the ground. And it came from a place of defiance where, okay, you killed Shirin Abu Akleh, 10 of us are going to come, 100 of us are going to come. And it really came from that kind of thought process. Because you realize the importance of a story being told. And it wasn't accidental for me that Shirin was killed in Jenin. That means there is something that needs to be hidden and concealed. So I also picked, my first story was picking up exactly where Shireen left off, which is Jenin refugee camp. There was a talk that I gave this Monday at the CCCB, and I think for me it was an important talk, and I was nervous about it because often, and I tried to say this, but oftentimes as Palestinians we're brought on to try and give testimony or say our personal stories instead of speaking as experts. And this was a time where I really wanted, and I was given the space to be able to try and explain a technical version of what's happening to us. And there were seven levers that I identified, not just me, this is obviously the work of many thinkers that I've borrowed from, as well as many Palestinians. But there's something that we have recognized and outlined, is that narrative is systemic and it is intentional and it serves a purpose. And in the case of Palestine, there were many ways in which we were erased in media reporting and academic research, and just in conversational talks. And the seven R is the grammar of agency, one. Two, the category warfare. Three is the moral arithmetic of which life is grievable. Four is platform dialects and attention economies. Five is censorship and coded speech. Six is bureaucratic poetics. And seven is the concept of time. And I will try to explain briefly what they mean kind of together in each. But you think of grammar of agency and you want to think about who gets the verb and who is spoken to in passive. Why is it Israelis are killed by Palestinian terrorists and Palestinians dead? Or Palestinians die. No name of a perpetrator, and it's as though it was a natural occurrence. So it's who gets agency. And then there's the category warfare, where, you know, there's a facilitation of creating different social groups. You have the militant, you have youth, you have civilians, you have terrorists, you have prisoner, you have hostage. And what that means is that when you put people in a category, you associate them with a protocol and a process. So a prisoner, a Palestinian prisoner, is assumed to have committed criminal activities and went through a judicial process that said, oh, he's going to prison, while a hostage is an unlawful and unfair holding of a person. Things like rioter means we can shoot them. Protester, that's an act of democracy. Then comes things like whose life is grievable. Why is it that, you know, I saw many stories of Israeli soldiers who were active duty members that were killed in combat, that would get these entire pages just describing their background, their family, their personal details. And Palestinians are reduced to numbers. So it becomes really hard to grieve. To grieve that. Even as Palestinians, we couldn't grieve each other. So it's who's becomes personal, part of the global community. The other thing is attention economies. You want to look at why places like Instagram limits to 1 minute videos or before the extension, or why it's quick reels. And that's a engineering of attention for people, so that you can see, you know, stories of laughter, stories of violence, funny stories right after each other, and suddenly your brain isn't processing, but it is also not able to focus for extended periods of time on what it could be considered boring or isn't clickbaity or doesn't have that music. They've created an economy on attention, and that's terrible when it comes to global violence and being able to confront it. Then comes the censorship and the coded speech. Things that we saw, you know, on social media platforms denying us the ability to say Al-Aqsa, still Aqsa in Jerusalem. So I had to say Dome of the Rock, even though they're actually distinctly, they're not far from each other. They're a few meters. But in the future, when you want to follow an event of violence, I'm saying Dome of the Rock when it was Al-Aqsa. That changes the trajectory, right? But you're choosing the closest proximity. So our language mutates. It becomes encryptions. It becomes codes for people to decipher instead of something legible and easy to understand or absorb and accurate more than anything. And then comes things that we're seeing as bureaucratic poetics, which is violence through bureaucracy, and it means violence without a scandal. You don't have to kill Palestinians in the West Bank. You just change a bunch of laws, right, and focus that there's a judicial process here, and that way there isn't an urgency around it. It's not seen as, oh, you know, thousands are being killed, but thousands upon thousands are being mass displaced, and that is violence too, and it's because of laws. So it is this bureaucratic poetics. So it becomes legal procedure, not ethnic cleansing. And then there's the concept of time. Where is the urgency? Why is it when attacks happen against Israel and when attacks happen against just the white population in general from someone from the global south, there's this uproar and urgency that this matter has to be dealt with now. On October 7th, Israel said, we have to go now and attack. It was hours and within their declaration of a full-blown war. But Palestinians were being bombed for decades, for years, and they were told to endure. The reports on the violence on our bodies had no urgency. It was just something that's happening. So it's this concept of time. So it's these seven levers, which can be boring when you want to get into them, but they're important because they outline how journalism can be adversarial to power by avoiding these traps. And it reminds you that, you know, before the bombs drop, people are killed with language or the lack of it. This is an important point to speak about. The manufacturing of a consent is a concept that, as Palestinians, especially in the last 2 years, have talked about a lot. And it comes from this recognition that policymakers and warlords require either the support of the global community or at least the non-interference of them, right? So just don't interfere. And what that means is you want to engineer an ignorance so that it becomes, oh, well, you didn't say anything, so you must have consented. And this is what manufacturing consent means. It's you being complicit without really knowing you are complicit. And the way in newsrooms this happens is bureaucratic poetics. It is policy. This is the style. Oh, we just, you know, we're just following protocol. This is not how we report. And we were speaking about this. I was speaking about this with Ben Ehrenreich, who is a writer and who has covered for places like the LA Times and the New York Times and written exhaustively on Palestine. But these were issues he had to deal with in the newsroom. And as Palestinian journalists, it's different than international correspondents. Because not only do we have to deal with the style and protocols of how editorial policies are, but our entire legitimacy is discredited from the beginning. So we enter with editors telling us, you need to fact check this not once, not twice, but three times. I used to have to give in all my audio recordings, even though sometimes that's, you know, you don't share your sources at times. And I would have to give them two different quotes from the same person. And none of my peers had to do the same. But I had to do that as a Palestinian and as a Palestinian covering Palestine, which I don't mind. I would never mind just giving very bulletproof evidence. But it is labor. And what that means is that I would have to do double the labor to let people know. And it's important that people know because we don't want them to be consenting without real knowledge, without that. We don't want the engineering of their consent. So we've spoken a lot about manufacturing of consent and what that does to global audiences. But I think there's another important thing that we're not discussing enough, and that is the manufacturing of danger. So how do you get people to agree to something? Why is Israel has the right to defend itself repeated so much? Because essentially there was a manufacturing of this Arab and Palestinian and Muslim danger. These categories, right? The category, categorical warfare that we spoke about. And what that means is that people think that by supporting an oppressive regime, they're actually supporting humanity in a way, because there was a danger manufactured. And that's how consent is created, right? That's how people consent to things, because I don't think people are inherently psychopathic. That requires an engineering, and it's often a playing on fear and anxieties and concerns that people have. So my way of confronting the manufacturing of danger is by taking what is scary and just reporting on it. So I know a lot of people in the world were afraid of the idea of the Palestinian fighter. So I went and I interviewed fighters, and I reported their stories, and suddenly that breaks, you know, because oftentimes it's our imagined idea of something. Even as Palestinians, we often tell ourselves we have an imagined idea of Israel as this big monster that cannot be, you know, beaten. That's it. This is the reality we have to live under. And then also you humanize Israel and you realize, hey, wait, this is something that is developed, that is created by people that can be confronted and challenged. And it's the same with Palestinians. You think there are these monsters that are not just, you know, trying to erase and Israel and kill all the Jews is what they keep saying Palestinians want to do. But you show them the fighter, you show them the mother, you show them the political element of what it means to be living in a house, and a settler comes in, takes half of the house, literally, and says, this is mine now, which is what is happening. This is, for example, the story of Muhammad al-Kurd, who we see as this writer and thinker and a poet. But why did he have to create that language in these words? It starts where the settler came into his home. And, you know, our writing is an act of resistance as well. And it's the same for the fighter. So you kind of show that the banality of things. And that's how you challenge, I think, the manufacturing of danger and subsequently the manufacturing of consent. So when we're reporting and dealing with editors, there is a constant negotiation with what we are allowed to use, what we are not allowed to use. And early on in my career, first as a writer and an analyst, and then more into reporting, it was the basic words like occupation, apartheid, that I say is basic because that's the reality. But to editors not in the field, it's like, oh, how could you say apartheid? How could you say occupation? No, we, you know, let's just stick to the facts, Maryam. And for me, this is the fact. It is an occupation. It is illegal. There's apartheid. And for me, in the beginning, we would speak with the editors. And how I would do that is I would say, here are the facts. There is an 8-meter high wall. Here's a story of a family that cannot go to this area, but the Israeli family was able to go. Here's the video footage of that. The water sources are denied for one group of people and given in excess to another. Here's also footage and reports on that. Please tell me what the word is. If it is not apartheid, I would love to learn. And at times that would allow for editors to sit and think, and they still wouldn't let me write apartheid, but they would write like, oh, okay, there's a separation or segregation happening. And that helped give leeway, at least for me. Sometimes I wouldn't push too much because the reader is more important for me. And I think when you outline all the things happening within and you contextualize a certain report or event, people will kind of recognize, this seems like apartheid, or it just seems like a bad thing. They don't need the words sometimes. And then there are other times where, you know, in when we saw a genocide unravel, we could not compromise on terms. I didn't have the time to sit weeks, sometimes months, to get an editor to allow me to say a word. So that was a red line for me. And that's where we moved towards more alternative media. We stopped really pitching to the major mainstream networks, CNN, The New York Times. We, as Palestinian writers, began trying to boycott it until it adheres to journalistic integrity. BBC likewise. So those were red lines. It became a point where I'm no longer negotiating. I am complicit in journalistic malpractice. So that had to become a red line. But for me, there's also another issue. I think because I'm in Palestine. And that means I'm not just working as a reporter. I'm often brought on by international and foreign correspondents to either be a translator or a fixer or a producer. Anything so they just won't say co-author, right? And my red lines on the field are different. Because then I'm not negotiating in how something will be reported. In the field, I'm negotiating with how we are treating the Palestinian. And oftentimes, international correspondents will come, and the way they're speaking with Palestinians is either without interest or as an interrogation. They I'm talking about just average civilian Palestinians, mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, that had just experienced something traumatic. And my red line has been in the field is I cut it off. So if I see disrespect happening, I cut off the entire interview. I apologize to the Palestinian family. I say, you know, we have our little conversation. And to the international correspondent, I just look at them and I say, please go revise, you know, the ethics of journalism, and then you can do the story. Because a story will begin in the assumptions you had while carrying out the interview. So those are my red lines on the field. It's not a negotiation with language. It is a negotiation with positionality and power, you know? So there is a hierarchy in journalism, and it is about positionality. On the field, when international correspondents come to report, they have more capacity to access areas that Palestinians can't. The way soldiers treat them is differently because, you know, they're with the GPO, Israeli-issued press cards, which links them to their international desk. So there's more fear from international scrutiny if anything happens to these journalists, which we recently saw with the team of Jeremy Diamond with CNN in the West Bank. His team was recently detained, and it became a big story that the Israeli army within hours, issued an apology. This has never happened with Palestinians. Shireen was killed, and it's been years and still no accountability or acknowledgement of that crime. So there is a hierarchy of safety. Instead, as Palestinians, we remove our press insignia at this point from our cars, from anything that identifies us, for soldiers and settlers, because that means we can get shot. We are actually targeted for being journalists. 300 media personnel have been killed in Palestine, in Iran, in Lebanon, and Yemen by this regime. So there is that hierarchy. But also what that means is that there is more value given to when an international reporter and a foreign reporter covers the same story that a local journalist covered. It's as though it has more credibility. And international audiences are more likely to hear it. But there's also a fairness in that regard, because I'm more likely to understand and hear something from a local journalist covering somewhere else in the world, because I know that reporter. I understand. So that's why journalists are entrusted by their communities to bring the stories back. But they do have more credibility also because of prejudice and the constant saying that Palestinians are biased or unobjective as journalists. We're either said we are that, or we're just flat out terrorists and worthy of being killed. But even here, the issue of objectivity is engineered. It is by design. There is no such thing as objectivity, because we are people. You will necessarily be influenced by what you hear, and you will come with assumptions that you carry, right? But as a journalist, it's not exactly being objective. It is your ability to report on all sides. Again, Palestinians don't ask for preferential treatment, and there shouldn't be anywhere, but show all the sides. This is how readers and audiences can realize what is happening. But look how sinister this is. They keep saying Palestinian journalists are not objective, but do you know who covers for CNN and BBC and all these major networks in Palestine? It's Israeli journalists. And yet they're considered objective. But they're Israeli journalists that identify with Zionist ideology, which is embedded within the displacement of the Palestinian. So here, this is objective. But if it's a Palestinian, no, there's a bias there. And it shows you, yes, how we're fighting that. We're constantly fighting that. And that's why Palestinians are required to, you know, document and record and archive and get four sources or three sources on the same topic. Local journalists have an exhaustive knowledge that is gained from the field. This is knowledge of the territory, but also the history of it. We know which areas did not have settlements on them 5 years ago, which areas are now settlements. We have an understanding of the language, right? Because sometimes even in translation, if you don't have someone that understands language in its cultural context, it can be mistranslated. And we actually saw this in Gaza. We saw the Israeli army go into filming walls that had the calendar in Arabic. And they said, look, Hamas operatives are Hamas operatives are writing the names of, you know, all the Jews they want to kill. This was put on BBC without anyone fact-checking. It says Sunday, Monday, Tuesday in Arabic, but they didn't even fact-check that. So it's important, because local journalists at least know, you know, at least won't embarrass you like that, you know, they'll tell you, hey. So even knowing the language and the cultural aspect is important. So that's an example, because sometimes when people are sharing traumatic stories as well, they're saying things that are reflective of something else. And it's important to recognize that. And that's something we learn, and we do it in our context. And you gain it from speaking with so many people across all segments of society, from the officials to the civilians to the fighters to, you know, just workers. And it's just different in understanding. And what that does is that you carry a lot of testimonies with you, right? So the local journalist is important for comprehensive understanding of a situation. But what has been happening in the last 2 years is that as local journalists, because there wasn't a focus on the daily acts of violence, the records, the documentation, we were doing a lot of that. And it was happening at such speed and intensity that we didn't have time or capacity to do the long-form stories. And long-form is important because it shows you the changes that happen in a place. So, you know, we needed to show how the north of the West Bank changed in the last 5 years and is now being annexed. But what happened? And these are long-form stories that we can't do. And this was brought to my attention by Maryam Daqa, who is a journalist that I profiled as part of a larger profile on women journalists in Gaza. And Maryam was killed in the process of that report. But some of her last words were, a really important thing that we need is for people to do long-form reports. You know, she said, we're exhausted, but I will keep taking pictures of people being killed. I will keep taking pictures of the displacement in Gaza. But there is more that needs to be reported, and we need help with that. And I fully agree. We do need help with that. We really need help with that, because even me, and I think for me, the war began before the genocide, because in the West Bank, there were airstrikes happening in the camps. But I was also constantly just collecting testimonies from the refugee camps, from places nobody wanted to go, especially not English-speaking media. And I wasn't able to write the story because I was still focused on pushing out the hard news for the world. And now I'm stuck with all these testimonies that I don't know what to do with. And that, when, as a journalist, as a person, that's a big deal. Because when you walk into someone's home and you say, my job is to relay the story, and then you collect so many and you still didn't relay that story, you feel that you failed your responsibility and your obligation. But it's because we're not being given the space to even breathe, to be able to report. And I think that's part of the strategy as well. It's not just kill journalists. It's not just censor journalists. It's exhaust them. You know, in the end, we're flesh and bone too. The people that work in this profession are flesh and bone. And I think perhaps the journalists in Gaza and their capacity to endure made the world forget that. But they are under starvation, under bombs, under losing their families. They're people, Yanni. And it's so sad that we have to, I guess, not just remind the world, but remember ourselves in a way. You know, I was just thinking now, I was like, you know, we're having this conversation, and I'm also here meeting, you know, different journalists in Catalonia as well. And we're thinking, you know, issues with journalism. And I've been thinking, what is really the added value? Because a lot of this we know, and we're unpacking a lot, you know, the censorship, consent, the malpractices that we see with media. But it's now I've been just constantly trying to think about, where do we go from here? And one issue that we seem to have and haven't, perhaps I haven't at least, delved into, I think, enough with myself and out loud, the future, the issue of imagination, and how important journalism is to not just absorbing violence and then becoming, you know, crippled by it, but it creates space for what people want to build in the future. But international correspondents always ask Palestinians about the future through the two-state solution. It was always like, okay, well, do you want one state or two state? And that was the extent of what the future holds. Or it's always a question, or constantly a question of, the reality is grim, you know, do you always think it will be this bad? But it never allows us to imagine. So they've confined our imagination, and now there's an importance in trying to formulate a framework of reporting that expands people's imagination and critical thinking for the future. So that's something also I really want to learn more about, and you know. So when a full-blown war was declared on Gaza, a lot of the energies of journalists in the West Bank and in Jerusalem as well, and Palestinians with Israeli citizenship, I think all attention focused on Gaza, because we recognized what was going to happen. Almost every Palestinian knew what was going to happen in October 2023. Gaza was about to be obliterated. So we focused a lot of our energy in terms of attention there so we can get as much information out. Israel was targeting telecommunication networks. Journalists were being killed. So we focused a lot on there. And we also realized something very dangerous was happening in the West Bank. We saw settlers being armed with military-grade weapons. They were being trained by the army. They were moving closer to take more lands. But we kept saying, this is not important. Let's focus on Gaza. It's fine. 4 Palestinians were killed by Israelis in the West Bank. It's fine. 400 were just killed in Gaza. So it's not a suffering Olympics, but we recognized an urgency for our besieged people. And they are our people, even though we're divided from each other in territory by Israel. And then when a ceasefire kind of was put into effect, notwithstanding that it's not really a ceasefire, but there was a pause moment, we really realized that West Bank is essentially almost gone. And I think that was so shocking for Palestinians, is that not only is the West Bank gone, nearly all capacity for Palestinian resistance has been taken out. So in the West Bank right now, not only are Palestinians seeing their homes being taken and waiting their turn, but everyone is so afraid of fighting back because Israel ingrained in everyone's head, we will do to you what we did in Gaza. This is what Israeli officials and settlers tell Palestinians. So there isn't even capacity to fight back. We see Gaza as the rough draft to what is happening in Lebanon, to what Israel is also trying to do in Iran, right? But what I think is perhaps more accurate, if we go a little bit back in time to 2021, 2022, the refugee camps in the West Bank were the rough draft. Israel began there saying, oh, there are Palestinian terrorists, the resistance fighters. And so they enacted collective punishment on the camps. They were killing people indiscriminately, demolishing homes. And then we saw that replicated in Gaza, and it just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger because it begins with the microaggressions. It began with Israel saying Palestinians don't exist if we really want to go back. And then it started to bomb them, and then it started to genocide them, and then it's expanding now to Lebanon and further. So I think really the rough draft isn't Gaza, and we should not see that, because it puts a mistake in our minds that we might start believing that it has to get to that level for us to recognize something is very ugly. But it happens a much smaller level and more intricate. I think many people didn't recognize the similarities between what was happening in the West Bank and what happened in Gaza, because Israel divided us and our experiences are divided. The violence that happens in Gaza is often through bombs, complete besiegement, starvation. In the West Bank, it's policy. You know, in Gaza, I don't think this is obvious to many people outside of Palestine, but Palestinians in Gaza never saw an Israeli before October. They only know drones and bombs that are sent by Israel. In the West Bank, we live surrounded by the army and Israeli settlers, so there's more face-to-face contact. For Palestinians in Jerusalem and those with Israeli citizenship, they are living amongst them. So I know Palestinians in Haifa that would have to go to Israeli universities, and they would tell me, Maryam, we are amongst our killers. I would have to sit in a room with a soldier that just served in Gaza, and I can't say anything. So it's different forms of violence. The bombing in Gaza, policies and military rule in the West Bank, and in Jerusalem and Israel, it's cultural repression, it's political repression, so it changes forms. It's funny because you say fighter about Khadr Adnan. And my first impulse, Khadr Adnan is someone that is seen as a fighter. But in my head, fighters are the fighters that I've seen in the camps, like armed resistance. And Khadr Adnan was someone that fought with his body. So he was a hunger striker. He's not, you know, someone that carried the weapons, but he fought with his body. And he was someone that was intentionally killed through medical negligence by Israel, having been someone that was being held under no trial or charges indefinitely. And they refused to release him and chose to let him be killed or die in Israeli prisons rather than release someone that's not even convicted. But it was interesting in my head because, yeah, I was like, is he a fighter? And then I remember, yes, he is. I think as journalists, and I do try to do this in my work, is the story isn't about us. This is something we always have to remember. The story is about others. The extent of us that is in there is really in just kind of a perception place or lens. And it's an important thing, but we really should allow others to be the authors of the story. Maybe this is something that needs to be addressed in journalism, is allowing others to be co-authors of a story, because I recognize that journalists, you know, that come and interview Palestinians, they say, you know, we can't send you the story beforehand, but I'll send you the quotes I used. And then later on, you'll see the quotes used were fine, but they're placed in a context where they come, you know, after an Israeli soldier, between another analyst, and then a paragraph of, you know, that journalist interpreting that quote differently. So maybe we do need approaches to co-authorship that really allow the different stories to be told, and to recognize that sometimes less is more. So we're constantly told you need to bring in two quotes or three quotes from three different people. And sometimes it's okay to just bring one and try and contextualize that with a broader story. And I think I try to do that some more times than not. There were journalists that came and covered the different, you know, parcels of life, really, in Palestine, especially in areas like Ramallah. But what they did was they made it seem like there is no occupation, too. So there is a fine line in showing the complexities that there is an occupation and Palestinians are being repressed and oppressed. But Palestinians are also not just Israel's victims. They're also Palestinians. And what that means in exploring that. And I do think it relates a lot to the insistence on giving value to things. So art. Palestinians give value to art. You see it in even the prisoners. They will use the smallest things, but there's an entire genre of prisoner art, of things that Palestinian detainees have done while they were in prison with whatever was available to them. And, you know, somehow they would sneak it out and find a way for it to reach an exhibition. And you would see that they use this art to be able to also remember that they can express themselves in different ways and that they can measure the passing of time through that. So it's interesting how we cope with different things by allowing us ourselves to do it. And I think art has been a refuge. In two things have been a refuge for Palestinians: the academia, the academics, and art is a second. You know, it's not accidental that Palestinians have some of the highest rates of graduate studies in per population size. But it's also because it's the only way of being able to go outside of the occupation, outside of the territory and that mindset. So they become academics and they recognize the value of that because it is denied as well. But it is a very fine line because you do want to see how Palestinians find life and persevere and find joy and celebration. But we can never miss the fact that it will always come with a certain just feeling on the heart and the chest that is heavy. And that is because Israel is still there with a boot on our necks. Even when you're not in Palestine, you would see Palestinians all over the world. A lot of their exhibitions, a lot of their work revolves around, again, just this idea of freedom and overcoming and confrontation, because there is a reality they cannot deny. And I think that's important. It's important for Palestinians to stay aware of that. No matter how ugly of a reality it is, of course not to define ourselves with that. Because when you see a Palestinian artist creating art about Palestine, they're also the artist who happen to use that skill and talent for Palestine. They're not an artist because you. So it allows that personhood of separation, but aware that there is a cause, and it is an urgent cause that requires my labors to be put into it. I will be honest. This would have been a much easier question to answer 2 years ago. Now we recognize that Palestinians are more than victims, and we see ourselves as more than that. But the spaces of creation outside of what Israel is doing in violence right now, it's difficult to discuss. Because as part of our culture we like to be outside in the mountains. Even the houses used to be designed in a way that's similar in the Levant and in Syria, you know, where there's the courtyard where everyone gathers. The village would have a place where everyone comes and gathers. So gathering, togetherness is very much part of our way of being. And right now, Israel is creating shrinking spaces so that it's difficult to travel between city to city, and in some areas, just from neighborhood to neighborhood, because there's always a risk of fatal violence on our bodies. So what that means is that there really are shrinking spaces and inability to think beyond that mode of just trying to make it one more day. And there are initiatives and there is creation happening. But unfortunately, you would recognize that many of it is going from the outside in, not from the inside out. So any support is being called for from abroad right now, because really just being able to stay on your spot is a labor right now in Palestine. Notwithstanding this, I think Palestinians, there's a really important distinction in how a Palestinian perceives themselves and how the world perceives them. We don't see ourselves as victims. We understand very well we are being oppressed. And this is why Palestinian language has a lot of things like struggle in it. We are a people in struggle. We don't say victims. That vocabulary is actually borrowed, mostly from the West. But we say we are in a struggle. The world might perceive Palestinians as only the victims of Israel. And that goes back to how media covered it. Either we were being killed by Israel or we don't exist. So it's on also the outside world to rupture that perception of the Palestinian. Because again, when you realize, when we're asking things like, what are the spaces available? There are certain examples, and right now it is difficult to give real, tangible efforts happening because a lot of it is from outside in. Inside, it's working at a very community-based, very small level right now to ensure survival. But yeah, Palestinians don't see themselves as the victims. But there is also the other thing, and when I'm speaking with people non-Palestinian from outside of Palestine, there are at times where we're given a lot of value and a lot of weight, but also we don't have the answers. Like, I get to ask, you know, how can we help? And a lot of times I genuinely don't have an answer. And we go through the list. You can boycott, you can divest, you can sanction, make sure you're amplifying Palestinian voices. But the real work is in the details of your community that I'm not aware of, right? Just like how it's in the details of the Palestinian community that I'm saying we should report more on. And that takes me to another thought, where the issue of journalism, I think, or reporting an international exchange of knowledge, is that there is still the one-way travel, which is from Palestine to the outside, from the global south to the outside. The international correspondents aren't reporting to us also what is happening abroad. And this is important because as Palestinians, we are isolated, or we'd send our correspondents to cover, but we're locked in. So there's also that issue of how information travels. But that's a whole other theme on its own. Yeah. Yeah, that's the issue with extractivist knowledge. When you are constantly taking from a certain area, like the global south, like Palestine, for example, and relaying it to the west or taking it into one direction and always relaying it in a form of either problem or exotic, you know, or like mystic or amazing and grand, like, oh, the resistance is also, we glamorize it, even though it's bloody and it's ugly and it's painful. But when you take that all in one direction, what happens also is the receiving population of that information thinks they're fine. There isn't also that critical thought of, okay, well, wait, what is wrong in my society? Because it's an absorbing of all, you know, it takes away that self-reflective capacity. So there is that issue that I think as Palestinians, and especially I think those of us that ebb and flow between the north and the south, we try and to be critical in how we relay the knowledge. So we don't just say things happened. We're developing a way of conversation where we're informing audiences of ways that that can be consumed and perceived and read and what that means about them. And I think this is very new in terms of how knowledge production and reporting is being done. And it comes off as, yes, it might be firm and mean even sometimes, but it's because we are responding to the moment. And this moment is one that requires just, pardon my language, but like no bullshit. It needs to be done because lives are at stake. I mean, speaking about like diaspora Palestinians and their understanding of what's happening is a whole other issue, because they also were left to consume knowledge and information about the places they're from by being somewhere else, often the places that are inflicting or complicit in that violence. So they consume it also in the same way as, you know, I think a white American might. And that's why they go to solidarity actions, for example. And the issue with that is there's a forgetfulness of, sure, they don't experience the realities as they would have if they were living in Palestine, for example. Being a Palestinian abroad is a different experience. But they're still part of the conversation on where do we go from here. And there isn't there isn't reporting on that conversation in the first place. So it's part of the fragmentation that is happening. You know, more than half of Palestinians, for example, are abroad in diaspora or imposed exile. How do you bring them back into a conversation when, by design, the goal is to also keep them away from it? So it's another battle that I don't even think we began touching yet. Collectively, this issue of separation, real separation, and what does it mean for political realities, at least, and social realities. The issue with humanitarian aid in Palestine and in my work in it is what I realized it made sure that we remained seen as a humanitarian crisis, not as a political struggle. And that was really seen in the way reports are written and the way aid is being distributed, rather than targeting how there's a root cause to why our life-sustaining resources are not accessible to us. Because we can be very self-sufficient in terms of what we need, life necessities. And yeah, the humanitarian aid sector really just became a place of careers being built on the backs of mostly places in the global south, and as tools and instruments to keep tabs on the populations there, right? And it was strategic in a way that it pacified, in the Palestinian context, it pacified Palestinians. You were put at a place where you're not strong enough to fight back, and you're not quite dead, so you can't really claim that you're being attacked, right? You're kept in that limbo state. And it does come back to language and how we were always reported on, and how things like poverty were reported on in our areas. And yeah, I think it's just not just complicity, it was part of the design of maintaining control in the global south and in Palestine specifically, to not allow it to be what it is, which is a political struggle. The way the projects of humanitarian aid support are designed is not sustainable for long term. They have a duration, which is the life of the project, often 3 to 5 years, and it's based on funding, right? It's not created in a way where if the funding goes, this development can actually continue on its own. And then the other issue were the goals that were often placed in these projects are not just Western-oriented, but they don't respond to the ideas and understandings of the community. Like there's, for example, the issue of feminism that we have seen unravel in Palestine. Is there are always these talks about women's rights and how they should be engaging and, you know, patriarchy and how to tackle it. But it responds to the patriarchy of the white male colonizer, not the patriarchy that we see, which is different. It operates differently. And it comes with this idea that, oh, we're, again, it's very supremacist. We need to focus on the women and the children, as though for it becomes the killing of men became okay. You know, in the statistics, especially in Gaza, a lot of the emphasis became on the women and children. And I get that, and it's very important. But the higher population that was being killed and eradicated was also the male population. And they deserve to be recognized. My brother deserves to be recognized. My father, my uncle, you know, their lives matter as well. And that's the problem with that. And it assumes that the woman is weak, but you know, in Palestine, we think, a lot of my friends and I, we were part of feminist movements and development, grassroots organization. And we would share the similar stories of our grandmother, who might have been illiterate, might have never known what the word feminism is, or in Arabic, nasawiya, but embodies it. You know, her word will go. And she didn't require permission from anyone, and she didn't require a word to tell her this is what you are. She kind of just took her womanhood and moved with it in a way that was defiant. And I think that's a feminism that's not understood by the West. And the Western gaze, for example, also has designed these big concepts such as freedom, democracy, liberty, feminism in this case, and associated it with things that are irrelevant to us, right? And the problem is that they used it to justify the violence that happens against us. I constantly hear things like, oh, as a woman, you know, are you allowed to dress however you want in Palestine? And I remember I used to get so defensive. I'd be like, of course. You know, and I'm like someone that I, you know, I have my tattoos. I don't wear my headscarf. I am Muslim, though, but I'm not visibly Muslim. And then at some point, it just hit me. And I started asking myself, why is that the metric? Why is that the metric, right? Because they're not saying, can you wear whatever you want? They're saying, why don't you wear less? And that, you know, what if I don't want to? If it's about what I want. So the idea of feminism and the movements that we saw, white feminism movement, was really reflected on also the humanitarian aid projects, right? And what the concept of liberating a woman means. And the same thing as the concept of what supporting youth meant. And it was always this passive knowledge, things like teaching Palestinians their rights and international law. But when the moment came for us to actually use that knowledge, it's as though we had to teach the world about their rights of you know, just legal, basic human rights. So it's, again, these things that were also problematic is that they didn't fill the gap that was needed by the community or wanted by the community. But we took it nonetheless. We accepted it. And if anything, learned it with flying colors. But yeah, it kept us in a as captives in that Western gaze as well. And again, in this way, knowledge was flowing from the outside in. It wasn't the extraction from of testimonies for the North. It was the North sending the lessons. This is what you should be doing. So it shows you the inequality of knowledge. It's the hardest thing to not have a language to not just describe a reality, but to be able to respond to it. We don't want to just talk to hear our voices or just write to write. It's a form of interaction. But then I keep remembering things like the word Nekbe, catastrophe, was formulated after the catastrophe of 1948. A Palestinian academics and writers got together and said, what can best describe what we just experienced? And they came up with, or employed, the word Nekbe. It is translated to catastrophe, but that's not the accurate translation. It's closer to massacre, slaughter, sacrifice, Nekbe. In Takabna, we were, a Nekbe was inflicted on us. But it was translated to catastrophe, and I think that's a failure because the world didn't understand what Nekbe meant. They understood what catastrophe meant. And here's the falterings of translation. I think also perhaps if we translated Nekbe to a language other than English, we might have found a more accurate translation, but we must use English, which is a colonial tongue, to describe it, and that makes it hard. But yeah, we're still trying to find the language that describes today, because things like genocide, ethnic cleansing, they're symptoms. They're not the process, what is happening. And unfortunately, the only way we can find language as Palestinians that reflects our reality is if we're able to talk to each other, and we're being denied the capacity to talk to each other. It's easier to speak to other people around the world than it is for us to talk to each other, in that it limits our suppression, or it suppresses our capacity to express. I mean, Palestinians do say this frequently, is that with our liberation is also going to come the liberation of Israelis, right? And also the liberation of Jewish communities that argue Israel is the safe haven for Jews when it really should be the world, right? But the thing is, when you're looking at Israeli society, it's not just that they're being imprisoned. They are being engineered also in a way to understand violence differently. That's why Israel insists on the right to defend itself, for example. But we have reached a point beyond that at this point. Violence has just become so ritual that there's less thinking about it anymore. And the Israeli regime is very strategic and intentional. You know, a lot of Israelis are traumatized from a young age into like just thinking about Jewish traumas. So that the never again narrative, that kind of language, is really ingrained in them. And of course, they're denied access to Palestinians, except in the case where they are the soldier or the settlers. That is the only engagement they can have with a Palestinian. Until you see, you know, of course, we've had some, you know, Israeli activists that started joining Palestinian protests, engaging in what they saw as not coexistence, but co-resistance, because they're anti-Zionists as well. But the issue with Israeli society as we see it now is that we're really at a place where reversing it requires just a dramatic effort on really waking them up. And I do think that a lot of that role falls on Jewish communities, because Israel draws its legitimacy from being a Jewish state. And we need Jewish communities to speak out against that, to just shake them and wake them up kind of from, it's a madness. It's psychopathic, the state that Israelis are in and Zionists are in. But they're engineered like this. But it's not enough. It's not enough to also understand, you know, this is the engineering of a nationalistic, ethno-religious, supremacist society. And I think there's a difference here and with Palestinians, is that there's a joke in Palestinian society that says, we're all heads, there's no population here, there's no public. Like, we're all presidents, there's no public. Because of, like, we have big personalities and opinions about everything. And, you know, when we see, yes, the PA is corrupt, but there's also a lot of confrontation to the PA in our societies. And you see Palestinians across the world also, they mobilize. We are known as a defiant people and confrontational. And I see that also in our upbringing. You know, we are defiant to the first authorities in our lives, our parents. You would hear a lot of stories from Palestinians of defying their parents at some point. And that rebellious spirit is really within us. And I think capacity to rebel against authority from youth, from being young, is so crucial. So when you're older and someone tells you, no, yeah, shoot that kid in the knee, I'm your commander, you can say no. And I don't think, as part of the engineering in Israeli society, rather than be able to challenge authority, they are taught that this is the authority, the army, the settler movement. This is what protects you from things like the Holocaust. So there is no critical, there's fear. They operate from fear. And I think that's a problem. And it's something that terrifies me about Palestine, that imagine the time after liberation, may we never be stuck in this mindset of never again and just live in fear. I mean, we always think of that mindset of, you know what, we overcame. Let's move on. We'll overcome whatever comes next too. Yeah. And that is what happened. The Crusaders came, the Romans came. Everyone passed through us. And we stayed. And we stayed, but everyone passed through, you know? The British came, the Ottomans came, Israel will have its moment, and then who knows who's next? We'll change, Yanni. And, you know, that's, I think that's so funny for me, but Palestinians even just, at some point, they stop saying liberation. They're just like, just change the system, just give us something new. You know, Zionism, khalas, that's old news. What's the next colonization project? And it's humorous, but it's also realistic. And I think, yeah, that's what helps us keep going. كله بيروح, احنا منضل. Everyone goes and we stay. You know, it's like, yeah.